The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Some fun tonight, fascinating material to go over with one of the most unusual and talented and extraordinary people in the field of ufology. She is Paula Harris, and when you talk about UFO researchers, Paula is really in a class by herself. She's an extraordinary person, and it's been a long time, God knows how long, since she's been on this program. She's an Italian-American photojournalist, writer, researcher, investigative reporter, primarily interested in ET and that phenomena. She's also a widely published freelance writer, especially in Europe. She has studied the extraterrestrial phenomena since 1979 and is a personal friend of many of the lights in the field, now some of whom are gone on to better places. In fact, from 1980 to 1986, Paula assisted Dr. J. Allen Hynek, talking about having a friend at the top. There's Hynek for you and his UFO investigations, of which Paula was involved with for 6 years. She's interviewed many top military witnesses concerning their involvement in the government truth embargo. It's more than an embargo. I call it a truth insult. I will also repeat what I've said so often. We who know and who simply study the evidence don't need the government to tell us what's real and what isn't. I think it's absurd. Paula, are you there? Welcome.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff, and I agree with you 100%. I don't need the President of the United States telling me, or any government telling me UFOs are real, or the New York Times, or anything. Oh. After all these years, the data is there.
Oh, it's overwhelming. It's a Mount Everest, and anyone who is intelligent and who denies it is... I don't understand how a mind like that can work. It's like they're wired funny or something, because this is linear, logical, pragmatic, cumulative evidence, hard evidence. We're talking physical evidence here, not just hearsay, as you well know. In fact, in 1997, I guess it was 97, you got involved with Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell. Now, that story remains in my memory as one of the most unusual in the whole field of ufology. Phil Corso, who after World War II was the American military governor of, what was it, Rome? Something like that.
Yeah, actually he was head of the intelligence community, the CIC in Rome, which was the intelligence community before the CIA, and because I was able to take him to Rome because he spent his time with us in Italy, I got to verify his office, where he lodged, everything he did. I dragged him all over the city, so and we were in Italy because my office is in Italy. I write for X Times magazine in Rome. I still do.
Yeah.
We sponsored him, and we were able to, really verify his claims. And unfortunately, Jeff, here in this country, he was not able to speak because there was a lawsuit against his co-writer. And Colonel Corso was also bashed and attacked by our own ufologists that tend to do that. And just before he died, he was angry. He was very angry. Called me on a Thursday. He died on a Monday. He said, they're a bunch of vultures. He said, I'm sorry I ever wrote the book. And the reason why he had written the book was for his three grandsons.
Yeah.
He had three small grandsons whom we brought to Europe because that was part of the deal. But my book, Conversations with Colonel Corso, is on Amazon right now. It is all audio tape. None of it is mine. It's all audio tape of everything he told me.
Oh, wow. That's an extraordinary discovery. I didn't know this. What a treasury. He was a man who had a lot to lose. He didn't have to do this, what he did, write the book the day after Roswell. How, when you look back, and you knew him very, very well, how was it that, and he did it for his three grandkids, but beyond that, he must have known he was stepping into a real rat's nest, because the field of ufology is unfortunately penetrated and a residence of a lot of people that I think I could speak for you are not the best quality people. And why they're there, you can only guess. There is certainly an effort to debunk and discourage people in the field, cause fights, attack people, defame people. It's not a good field. In the totality of it is there are some wonderful people in it and areas, and your work is at the top. So what about Corso, and why was it that he stuck his neck out? Because he did have a lot to lose.
Well, it was a deal he made with General Trudeau. And remember, Corso got the artifacts in 1960. So one of the arguments they use is, all of those things, the vibroptics and all that stuff, was in the main domain already. Well, of course it was. Our first crash, and I've been working on it for 5 years, was in 1945 in San Antonio, New Mexico. And of course it was Army Air Force then, Jeff. And you think the Air Force is going to throw that stuff in the trash? The only difference is the Air Force went one way, the Army went the other way.
Yeah.
And Corso in the Army in 1960, when he was working under the Kennedy administration, got his part of the artifacts. But it was in the general public because of the Air Force. What had happened was all of that stuff that comes from the many crashes in New Mexico was back engineered. I mean, what are you going to throw it out? So it was already in, the trouble is it was in big industry, and that's where we go into the military industrial complex. I mean, in my book, Corso tells me he went with huge amounts of money in an envelope. It was cash, so there was no paper trail, and he names the companies he went to, and he mentions that he was with Hermann Oberth, with Sarbacher, his German scientist.
He was with Oberth and, there you go.
He's German, and he knew Wilbur Smith very well. So if we know our stuff, if we're good journalists, if we do our homework, when they mention these people, we know that they're telling the truth. We know these people are telling the truth. And he stuck his neck out because it was he had told Trudeau, and they had talked to each other, the last one alive would tell the truth. And for a journalist like Paula Harris, Jeff, that was the reason why the secret is being kept secret. It's all about money. I thought it was about the fall of religion and the aliens and this and that.
Oh, no.
And fear and, war of the the worlds. It wasn't. It's about money. This stuff has gone into industry. Mm-hmm. It's all about money. It's about creating the propulsion system back engineering the craft, and all of that stuff. And it's so difficult to break that.
Philip Corso essentially seeded American industry carefully with a lot of this stuff, and everybody who studies history notices, and they can't deny it, there was an astonishing technological leap in this country in the 40s and 50s, and it hasn't slowed down one bit. And it all came from, basically, according to Phil Corso, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was seeded genetically from craft that crashed or were shot down, one or the other. The first crash, I think the big one was over here, was the Cape Girardeau crash. I don't know what they got right out of that one, but then you mentioned 1945. Then there's the crash at Socorro, the crash at Aztec, the Roswell crash. So Corso, did he not seed industry with a lot of this technology?
He did, because he was Army, but so did the Air Force. So, because remember, it was Army Air Force. So, yes, he did seed industries with this technology, like high-tenacity fibers, like the night screening device. I mean, when I first met him, he told me about the lens that the being wore, and he said that being wore a lens, and when you peeled it off, you could see the furniture in the Pentagon by taking that lens and walking up and down the hallways. And one of the things he said, Jeff, that you'll be interested in, is that he said that the beings that were in that craft were clones, that they were extraterrestrial biological entities, and that they were more afraid of who created them. And in my book, there's the autopsy report, because it was a microchip in one of the four lobe brains of this clone, which was created in a laboratory. We've built a whole ufology around clones, around little gray aliens, and that's what we're talking about tonight, to get off this little gray alien thing that we've perpetrated as, you know, the only part of ufology and abductions and so forth, because it's very convenient to put everybody under fear. But who really visited us in the 50s, 60s, 70s were space people.
Absolutely, there were people. Sure. How many different types? I don't know. You've got a better guess on that than I do. But let me go back to Phil Corso for a minute. I'm very sorry to hear that he was angry like that right before he passed, because he really performed an heroic service, in my view, coming forward with that material as he did. And he took a lot of cheap crap from people that he shouldn't have given the time of day to. I was very disgusted with the community, the way they handled Corso. It was just wrong.
Well, the trouble is, this is my theory, this is my opinion, I'll always tell you, and it's my opinion. The community is a cottage industry, and when you have all those people writing Roswell books, they certainly don't want something that says the day after Roswell, because it could be a bestseller. It wasn't in his lifetime, it was after. And so everybody's jealous about the Roswell books and all this, and he was never at Roswell. I have his military records, I put him in the book. He was at Fort Riley, Kansas in 1947 when he saw the body. It was coming across in a kind of a caravan. So, you know, his co-writer put the day after Roswell. Oh my God, you know, all the Roswell people are going, oh well, it's like a battle for books or whatever.
Right, it was an unfortunate title choice.
It was, because the man is very respected in the book. It says all the medals of honor he gained, and he did the Korean War, he did the Second World War, the Battle of Monte Cassino, which is a very bloody battle in Italy, and also he worked as the head of a missile battalion in White Sands. He had all these huge commands and should have been well respected. He was a nice guy. He was a wonderful guy.
Right. Well, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So how many crashes in New Mexico, Paula? You mentioned there were several. I mentioned several, but there were more.
Yeah, and you know what, I I'm a teacher, so I have a master's in education, so I'm going to recommend books to people tonight. Ryan Wood wrote a book called Magic Eyes Only. It has 93 crashes in it. 93. Some of the Kingman, Arizona crash, which had the J-Rod in it, is in that book. The 1945 crash, which I've been working on for the last 5 years, because the two little boys that saw not only the craft, they saw the beings, walked right up to the craft. The mark of the craft is still there, and the nine-year-old went inside and took a piece out of the craft. Nobody looks at this because, unfortunately, in ufology, we have the mythology that everybody believes in. You can't go off of that.
And I know.
Roswell is the Mecca. They don't care about anything else.
And stay on the road.
That's it. Stay on the road. If we just discover other stuff, it doesn't, you can't change.
What are we calling the 1945 crash officially?
I call it the 1945 San Antonio crash, 13 miles away from where the atomic bomb was exploded. The only person, I've taken all kinds of people and researchers down there, the only person that did extensive research with a drone and everything is Jaime Maussan, and he took this material, took it to Mexico, analyzed the metal, and the metal has it has integrated circuits in it. Right in the metal that the nine-year-old took out from it. But I couldn't do anything here because it's like the United States is a real blockage for not only research, but for, I mean, you say anything. You show pictures like I have on your website now of the beings. And they're the, and we have our own people just going after everything. You can't, everything is a hoax. Everything is Photoshop.
I know.
The pictures are too good. So you just guess how far you can get with a real story. Because
only as far as they, only as far as they'll let you.
Well, yeah, you get tired of them. I'm a field researcher, so when I say I worked on the 1945 San Antonio case, I mean I've been down there for 5 years, twice a year, to try to get and what was there at the time were the Manhattan Project scientists. I mean, the Owl Bar and Cafe. I walked in there, and they said to me, "Well, you know, they look like traveling salesmen because they all had a leather briefcase. We never knew they were going to explode a bomb. The city did not know." And the mother of Jose Padilla, who was a nine-year-old, was blinded when she opened the door at 4 o'clock in the morning because nobody told the town they were going to explode the bomb. I mean, that in itself is a big story.
She literally was blinded.
In one eye,
wow.
She opened the crap because they of the door because they lived about 13 miles from the and then the cattle and the amount of leukemia. I can't even. That was 70 years ago.
Yeah.
70 years ago, but I'm more. It's more like 72. But it, you know, these are big stories, and because I'm a teacher, and because I want history, I want to look at history, and because I am a field researcher, I try to follow the breadcrumbs, and that's I want to know why we're having visitations. I want to know when they really, really became powerful, you know, when we had a lot of them.
Yes.
I want to know where they were. I want to know what parts of the world are having them now, and it's Latin America. I'll go there eventually, because I want to know. I mean, there's no money in it. There's no fame in it. I mean, it's ridiculous. But as a journalist,
you're so right.
I just want to know. I mean, I think you want to know too, right?
Oh, I've been doing this for 25 years, and this program, and even before the program, I wanted to know. And I know. I mean, you know, I know. People who look at this honestly know. I haven't seen one documentary about the San Antonio crash, though.
Nobody wants to do it. I mean, they're afraid of getting... They're afraid. I mean, the first people that I brought down there, we had a problem with the second witness because he wanted a lot of money. He wanted a tremendous amount of money. And the only people that filmed him were in Switzerland. So I had to go to Switzerland to get the film footage on him. But the first, one of the first people that filmed it for me was James Fox. I mean, he came down and he filmed it for me because the mark of the UFO is still there. I mean, so
that's fascinating. That's fascinating.
It's better than Roswell in that, you know, we got the witnesses, we got the spot. Roswell is over strewn over 3 miles.
Right.
The pieces.
Right.
And we have a piece, and we have a piece on top of it all. And but James, I think like a lot of other people that came down with me thought I'm not going to risk my career just to, you know, do something that's ever been done before.
James Fox.
Because he did all the filming for me. I have his film footage. He just handed it to me. But what he did say to me, God bless him, because I adore him, he said, you know, Remy is telling the truth. I said, yeah, not Remy, Jose is telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And he had also interviewed Remy. He said, these two boys who are in their 70s are telling the truth. I said, I know. It doesn't
do you have
make any
Paula,
difference.
Excuse me, do you have both of them on film?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you're sitting on a documentary here.
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, I will do whatever I can to help you if I can do anything. This is a big, big story. When that craft came down in 1945 and the others subsequently came down, what brought them down? What's your thought?
Well, the boys were out riding on their horses, and they said, and I pay attention to this, it was a horrible, horrible electrical storm. And you've heard this before.
Yeah.
That the electrical storm, the lightning interferes with navigation, but there was also a tower, they said a radar tower there.
Right, we had some new high-powered radar that supposedly was interfering, and I guess it brought a number of them down.
Yes. And these radar towers, I didn't realize, but I think you've interviewed Ramsey, I think, who wrote the book on Aztec. They were portable. I didn't realize
they
were portable.
Yeah, I didn't know. There were a number of them. I don't know how many, but they did move. And there is somewhere on the Internet, there's some footage of one of them, what remains of one of them that was permanent. There was one that was permanent. The building is still there. It's old, decrepit, and concrete. And I can't remember what else about it, but... Yeah, these radars apparently caused real serious problems for these craft, which were essentially scout craft, as you mentioned, flown by clones.
Exactly. The boys described these, though, as more mantis-type, as they call them. They said they were, when they'd stand up, they were like a fire ant. What had happened when the boys were shielding themselves, they saw the craft come in, they saw it crash, they walked over the craft, and Jose heard squealing, he said, like when you shoot a rabbit, and he thought they were hurt, and he was going to run in and help them. He said he saw three of them kind of floating back and forth. They were standing up. They were spindly.
Were they outside the craft at this time?
No, the piece had broken off, so they could see what was going on. Piece had broken off.
Yeah.
So they could see these three of them.
How big was the craft, Paula, approximately?
30 feet diameter.
Uh-huh.
And,
10...
and actually, the mark is right there.
That's amazing.
You know, because it was the ground is had radiation. I mean, nothing grew.
Uh-huh.
The irony is, Jeff, you're going to love this. In the last 2 years, they've planted poisonous plants on that diameter.
How disgusting.
And I took Jan Harzan from MUFON down there with a crew to try to get those plants and see what in the world they were. And why they planted them only in that 30-foot diameter, I think somebody doesn't really want to come in.
Right. So,
digging.
Exactly. No, metal detectors, that should be excavated. I wonder if they got all the pieces out of there. I assume the Army Air Corps swept in there and cleaned everything up.
Part the guys were telling me the boys were telling me that what had happened was it was one of the first crashes, so they were playing like country music, and the same boys that they had seen in the Owl Bar and Cafe that were part of the Manhattan Project, because this is a month after the bomb, were trying to clean it up, and because they were tired of it, they took their foot and just pushed pieces into a berm.
They
were tired of all, you know, and they weren't even wearing hazmat suits.
This is the beginning of recovery teams.
Yes. They wouldn't even wear a hazmat suit. So I've written about it. I mean, it's on the internet somewhere. And I, of course, all my work goes to Italy because there's no magazine in the United States.
Not anymore. No.
So I don't know where to put it.
Paula, if there's anything you want, you have a beautiful website. If there's anything you want me to post, I'll be happy to put it up. Don't worry about that. We've got a great audience. These are very, very intelligent, wise people that listen. And you are being listened to all over the world right now. And they care. This crash, though, is very interesting because nobody really knows much about it. You're the authority. This craft came in, a large piece of 30 feet in diameter, probably maybe 10 feet thick in the middle. A big piece of it broke off. The kids went out there and they looked inside of it.
They stood 500 feet away from it because the little six-year-old started to cry. When the nine-year-old wanted to go in and help him, he started to cry. And what there was, if you can use your imagination, was burnt mesquite.
Sure.
You know, the mesquite bushes were burning. So he said, our eyes were watering, he said, and we couldn't really go close.
And they could hear the beings, and they could see the beings moving.
Yeah.
Do we know what happened to the beings?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, because I question these. I had to go all the way to Switzerland for the film footage of some of these, of the one that passed on, by the way, because that's the only film footage. And he was 6 years old, and he told me, and this is interesting for you, that what they shot into his consciousness was people falling out of skyscrapers. He saw visions, and there were no skyscrapers in New Mexico in 1945. He said, what I saw was this vision of people falling out of skyscrapers. And I found that extremely interesting.
Oh, fascinating.
Because the beings flashed that. Now, if you look at the fact that a lot of the problems with crashes or sightings, you know, like the Malmstrom Air Force Base shutdown, it's all about nuclear. It's all about nuclear.
I was going to ask you that next. Before that, though, these mantids are insect-like beings, people, survived. We don't know what happened to them.
Because it took 8 days to clean it up. The Army Air Force came to ask Jose's father to cut the cattle guard. And you can go there and see the cattle guard is cut. And they also created a road. So what happened? 8 days is a long time. The next day when Sheriff Apodaca went down with the father and the boys, they couldn't. There were no beings there. And the craft was just there. And it took a flatbed truck. That's what they'd had to build, like one of those A-shaped things to lift it up on the flatbed.
Yeah.
And the boys watched every day. I mean, they were
amazing. Now you couldn't get near it to watch, of course, anything like that.
But nobody knew because they were behind the trees, these two little kids. And you know, want to hear the irony? I read about this story because it was in a New Mexico newspaper when I was living in Italy.
Uh-huh.
And you got to know that I lived in Italy from 1992, and I came back in 2007. So I haven't been in the United States since 2007. I was teaching at the American Overseas School. And when I read about it in Italy, I said, why aren't my colleagues going out there? Why isn't somebody doing this? Why isn't somebody going to question these little boys? What's wrong with people? And I didn't realize that destiny would have it that I would end up doing the story.
Just to round this up, you've got film footage of both these kids, now adults, older men. We've got a lot of footage of the site. Poison plants have been planted in there now to prevent anyone going in there and digging and sifting and looking for metal. The metal that you know about from that crash had within it... part of it.
Nanotubes.
Microcircuits, exactly.
Nanotubes. And who did a story on it, as usual, by the country.
Yeah.
And he's giving me the DVDs, is Jaime Maussan. He did a 3-part series on it.
Yeah, Jaime's been taking too many negative knocks. He's done great work for a long, long time. And some people Crazier they're working for the other side, one of the other.
No, because one of the stories that you're going to see the photos on, Jaime flew across the ocean to do it with me in northern Italy. Jaime is a journalist.
Oh, yes.
He cannot look at a case and say, I don't feel like doing it because I'm going to get criticism.
No.
That. I can't either.
No, not a chance.
We got to do it.
Yeah. This is amazing. We're going to look at Paula's pictures here. But let me go back to the issue about the visitors. Now, whether you're talking about a scout craft with cloned grays operating it, you have to understand that the metal that they're made from is not just metal. It is embedded and it is full of nano and micro circuits, tubules, who knows what. These are incredibly advanced, sophisticated craft. And yet, radar and lightning and thunder, electromagnetic discharges, EMF, was able to bring a number of them down over the years. What a shock. I wonder if those ETs that were in that were rescued and picked up by some of their friends.
Well, now that you said that, I'm going to interject something. I am the journalist that printed the books on Clifford Stone.
Because
I have been with Clifford Stone for the last 10 years, and I printed his book, Eyes Only, and I recently asked Clifford Stone about what you just said.
You know, Clifford was, I think I had Clifford on this program, maybe one of the first programs he ever did. And I remember that story very, very well. You must tell him hello for me. He was on a number of times.
Well, he's telling the truth. He's crash retrieval. And I also asked him, how come, you know, Colonel Corso told me personally there were 52 different races categorized in the Pentagon, and Clifford told me there were 57. And I said, "What is that about ketchup? Like, why did you say 57? Is it like Heinz?" And he goes, "No." He said he had a manual. Now, Jeff, this is major. He had a manual, a first aid manual for 57 different species.
Oh, you're kidding.
So, in other words,
these crash teams, if they now apparently come across survivors, they have a manual, they identify the type, and they're given some basic first aid or mental equipment to deal with something that strange, that they can address it and medically try to help them. What an interesting thing. A manual identifying and profiling 57 different species that are known to have visited here.
Mythology in this country is Nordic, gray, and reptilian.
Oh, you got half a
Three
dozen
boxes.
At the most.
Yeah, they have to be a Nordic, they have to be a gray or reptilian. Ridiculous thinking. It is so ignorant.
Yeah, well,
I cannot believe people would do that, and if the aliens ever came here and just put us in three boxes and went back to their planet, you know, it would be ridiculous.
That's a very good analogy. Now, okay, let's go to this, Paula. Why do you think they seem to have such, and not all 57, but several of the groups, several of the species, seem to have an extraordinary interest in nuclear energy, nuclear weapons. We know about the Malmstrom, the missiles. The Russians had the same problem when an entire wing of their ICBMs were taken over by ETs, and there was a countdown initiated, and they couldn't do anything. They just had to sit there. It was stopped with, you know, seconds to go before launch. Like they're teaching us a lesson. So why the interest in nuclear? I feel personally that splitting the atom here really began what may turn out to be an extinction level event. But that's maybe just me.
Well, you're logical, Jeff. You thought about it. I mean, you know, one of the things that shocks me even about our field, the ridiculousness of it. Nobody uses logic. But I think that what the story is, and I cannot say they, if there's 57 different species, I think the ones that are interested in us, that are probably related to us, don't want us to have a nuclear event. And then I also believe that any kind of explosion, and that was major, what happened in Trinity, goes into other dimensions. And since this is a dimensional phenomenon, some of these beings are dimensional beings. They're not physical. They don't come from another planet. It's going to affect them. You are messing around with the natural
natural order of things. All those explosions in the 1950s, all those tests where they destroyed so many islands in the South Pacific. We did. The French did. How many bombs did we light off in Nevada?
Can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
Can I tell you a story about this?
Yeah.
You know so much. It's really a pleasure to speak to you because it is. When I was in Italy, the only time I was broken into in my apartment was when I was filming Guy Andronique, who was a geophysicist on the island of Fangatofa in the South Pacific.
Uh-huh.
They broke in and took everything, my cameras, my computers, and everything.
God, worldwide, it's this intrigue is something that will not honor any boundaries, borders, political regimes. It's above all that, all of it.
Well, it was the French. He was French, and he said on the island of Fangatofa, they had done 800 H-bomb tests. 800.
800. 800. Nobody knows this, Paula. I didn't know there was that many.
Well,
that's obscene.
He's in my book.
Yeah.
UFO is the first one, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon. He's in my book. Because all of my interviews in my books, I have five of them, are word for word. And what had happened was he said that there were 3 feet of dead fish on the runways. 3 feet.
Damn.
And then he said they had killed all the coral. And he said on two occasions, he was out on the field because he said the officers were in bunkers, but on two occasions they had flyovers of UFOs who just flew over. And so he said he jumped in a plane, followed them. Mm-hmm. The plane's instruments went haywire. Mm-hmm. And then when they were over the UFOs were over the horizon, the plane regained power. Now, if these ETs that everybody is saying are so hostile, had seen us kill all those fish, all the coral, and they didn't do anything except say, here we are, we're you insane people, we're flying over. And this, he told me it was 800 that the French did, but then he told me how many the Americans did out of the Atlantic near Argentina. H-bomb testing in the water. Now, I don't know why we need so many. And then why is this focus, even in the North Korean situation, on nuclear? I mean, it seems like that's a no-win chess
game. Of course it is.
It's a no-win chess game.
No, nuclear is no win, period.
Nobody wins.
Look at Fukushima. The North Pacific Ocean is essentially dead now. Most life is gone. Food chain is shattered. We are really going to face some incredibly hard times because of that. Now, when you talk about 800 tests, were these French tests?
French. We didn't even go into the Indians. You know, India did tests.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I know.
India did. The only thing that stopped the testing was the New Zealand journalists I think they risked their lives to go and stop that, and Greenpeace and all that. But this is H-bomb, which is much more powerful than the A-bomb.
Yes. I didn't know anything about the American tests off Argentina. Nothing. I've never heard this before.
Well, he gave me a little map, and he said, this is what happened. So I go to pizza with him, and I had a colleague come with me, because whenever I do a dangerous story, I always have a guy. I mean, I'm like a Scully, but I need a Mulder.
There you go.
I need a guy with me. Even when I went to do 1945, I had a guy with me that just came along with me and works together. And what happened was that when we came back from eating pizza, that my door was open. And I knew.
Nice.
This is seventh floor of a building near the Vatican. I lived in an apartment.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, my God, they came in. They took everything. It's like, so I knocked on all my neighbors' doors and said, look, you know, I want you to know I'm going in there. I don't know what's in there. I think they've taken everything. Now, he's still in my book. And I went and filmed him another time, so I have all this.
Uh-huh.
Everything that's in my books, I have audio for. Everything.
Wow. Oh. Amazing. All right, let me go back to this issue. There's the standard line, and our listeners know this already. The party line is that there's some kind of a galactic or even wider than a galaxy, hands-off policy. They're not supposed to come in and mess with our own, they can watch, they can look, There certainly are interactions, we know that, but they don't seem to shut everything down like the day the Earth stood still. And I personally feel that the only way to shake any sense into what's left of humanity is to give them an ultimatum like that movie. You denuclearize within the next month, or we're going to French fry the planet. The people are not going to listen. They're all into this thing for money and power. And anyway, go ahead.
We can't do that, though, Jeff, because we don't learn anything on a karmic level. If somebody comes in,
so they're leaving us to our karma.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know what's going to happen. We're going to kill ourselves off again like we've done before.
Well, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. And we're going to crawl back up out of the muck in another million years and do it again.
But we decide that. And the other thing that people don't understand is they're not coming down here to save us because we just create another religion.
Too funny. All true. Oh, yes.
All true. Yeah. I mean, you know what? They're looking at us going, now, if we go down there and we have coffee with them and we tell them how we live and how we have already surpassed this part of our evolution, they're just going to make a religion out of us. And that's not what we want. We want, this is why I have created the Laughlin Conference. It's November 2nd through 4th in Laughlin, Nevada. It's the fifth year, where it's UFOs and consciousness. Because even though I have some heavy hitters, I have five international speakers, and we talk about the responsibility humanity has. Because you and I have been talking about nuts and bolts. We know all the nuts and bolts. We know all of it. We know everything that happened. We know all the big cases. But now the real question is, where do we go from here?
That is the question. I didn't know you took over the Laughlin venue then.
Yes, yes. And I bring Bob Brown with me there, and he's a sweetheart. And I created a company called Starworks USA. In fact, I'd love to have you come. And what I do is, it is a conference where all the speakers listen to each other's lectures.
Uh-huh.
And not only do they listen to each other's lectures, they learn from each other. And most of them, five or six of them, are from, I have two from Peru, one from Italy, one from Spain, one from the UK, and one from Denmark.
No.
I mean, I bring them all in because people are shocked at these new stories. It isn't the same old, same old, same old.
Right.
And not only that, it's very intellectual, so it doesn't become what we have here, which is entertainment.
Oh, you're right. You're so right. That's exactly what. You know, I've been at this, like I said, 25 years in June. I'm not a condescending, arrogant type person. I have just never accepted an invitation to one event because it is basically exactly what you're saying. It's showbiz. It is entertainment. And I've got too much work to do. I'd rather read and study your work, for example, and go spend 3 days at a conference and see nothing that I didn't know or haven't heard about. But you sound like you're presenting information at a level that no other conference does. You're bringing international people together, and that's never been done that I know of.
Yeah, and I'm kind of, it has to be consciousness-based. In other words, I kind of stay away from the abduction stuff. I stay away from the conspiracy stuff, because even though I've been in the middle of it, I can't even tell you how much I've been in the middle of it.
Oh, I've followed your career. I have a pretty good idea.
I'm in the middle of it. I know all about that. I know all about chemtrails. I know all about,
sure.
I know all about that stuff. I don't feel that makes a difference. I think we have enough information. Now we need inspiration.
Well, you're taking it up to the ultimate level is what you're trying to do, and that is to be admired, and you're 100% right. Unless we can work in that level and make some progress, we're not going to be around. I'm sorry. I just don't see it. We're not going to make it.
Well, the thing is that I'm working in the Latin American arena right now, and the messages that are coming out of Latin America, especially, I was with Ricardo Gonzalez in the Atacama Desert in 2014 when he met a space woman. I mean, it's one he meets all the time, on the sand dunes. I was there in the dark of night with 70 people. The ships were over our head.
Who's the UFO researcher? He lives in Miami. He's a South American. He's Latino. He's been at this a long time. He went to the desert down there, exactly the one you described.
Are you talking about talking about Cystopods Wells, probably.
I may be. I can't remember. It's been too many years.
Cystopods Wells, I mean, if we look at the
timeline, that's not his name. That's not his name.
Are you talking about Robles?
Not Robles.
Down in Miami.
Anyway, he went down to Chile twice to that the Atacama Desert. And he went to the Maria Elena mining camp. He went to the town where he was into the Chupacabra thing when that was going on down there. And he found one landing site, which people saw in the desert, high up in the desert. And there were three tripod impressions in the ground. It was about a 60-foot in diameter craft from what they can estimate. And there were witnesses that said it was on the ground, and I think they ran. But anyway, the next day or the day after that, he was up there and they found the three impressions in the desert sand, and they traced the circumference of this craft, and it was a big craft. It was like 60 feet. But there was another area where there was a long line in the sand where a ramp had come down and sat into the sand. And he said from that ramp bottom in the sand where it ended, coming out of that ship and going off in all kinds of different directions, were these chupacabra-like footprints, like they were being released to run loose and maybe collected later. But they were being released in that desert up at that landing site. He got pictures of it all. He had foot casts made, and they landed those foot casts on a long flight in Spain, and they checked them there, and they were the same as Spanish footprints of whatever these creatures, animals are. If they're just hybrid creations and they're letting them run loose to see what'll happen, I don't know. But something got off that ship, he said, and he described the whole thing. Very interesting.
Well, I can't address that because it's something I know nothing about, but I can address one thing that you'll be familiar with. When Ricardo came back from his encounter with Ivica from the planet Apu, which is an Alpha Centauri, she said, and I was present, he was crying, he said, there's going to be a problem with water. So what we're getting is ecological messages, and what we had
right.
was three hurricanes with water.
Right.
Major water. She already knew. These people know.
Well, you could take it to the drinking water, too, which is rapidly declining all over the world. It's you're selling it for as much as they are oil now. Good drinking water.
She warned us. So what do we do? There were 70 of us. So I wrote an article. I said there's going to be this year a problem with water. And we had these massive hurricanes.
Yeah.
I mean, what it is an imbalance in our ecology. So I feel that if people want to know what the latest messages they are, and they're coming out of South America, they are ecological.
Interesting. Did you ever read Bob Pratt's book, UFO Danger Zone? Terror and Death in Brazil. Bob Pratt was a journalist for the National Enquirer, believe it or not. But as you know, many people who write for that or contribute to that are legit, honest journalists. He went to South America. I can't remember. I had Bob on the program many times, half a dozen times, a dozen times. And he would go out into the most remote villages he could get to in Brazil, for example, and spend a week there, talking to the villagers with translators if needed. And in every village, they had the same kinds of stories. Craft coming over, craft landing. One of them actually had a craft coming over, and this guy was running, and they dropped a kind of a net on him and caught him, and he was turned upside down and held in this net. Then they let him go. Wild stuff. The book is called UFO Danger Zone. Bob Pratt.
Okay.
It's well worth your time.
Well, I have 300 books I'm looking at right now
in
my library.
I'm
and
sure.
I love reading, and I'm reading right now Grant Cameron's Managing Magic. So
a good one.
And then another one that just came out. It's on my Facebook, and everybody must read it. And your friend Frank Chile must read it, too, because it's called They Are Here, Visitors Without Passports by Michelle Zinger. And it covers the Adamski, all the Adamski, the Amicizia case, and all the human-type alien interaction in Europe. So I'm reading all the time. So I will put that down.
That's a good one. Bob has passed on. But he left that book, and I think he wrote a couple of others. But his research in South America is I think, seminal. It's just really important. So, yeah, Bob
Pratt.
Yeah,
and people say, why are these human-type beings coming to the South American contactees? And my answer is this. If they came here, all we would do is just ask them about the propulsion system and the craft. We're not interested.
Oh, the military-industrial complex would consume them.
We don't care about who's inside. I mean, who cares? We'll kill them and do whatever we do to them.
Sad to say, you're right. Yeah.
And so if you go to Latin America, the people there, they're beautiful people. I mean, they see a spaceman come off a craft, they go right up to him.
Right.
And I think that's the only way you can have an interaction with a being from somewhere else is a heart connection. You can't do intellectual. What are you going to ask them? I mean, you can't do intellectual exchange. You can do a consciousness exchange where you look at them and you say, you're alive, I'm alive. That's about all we have in common.
Well, have you ever met one yourself, Paula?
Yes. Yes, I have. Through Ricardo Gonzalez again.
Uh-huh.
It's on my website for the details. It's also in my new book, All the Above and Beyond, because when I started interviewing all the South American contactees, there's eight of them, I got this message from Ricardo, who's 42 years old, and his group from the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. He texted me and he said, my contact, Antarel, wants to meet you. And of course, I'm going, that's baloney. I'm not going to believe any of that stuff. He probably wants publicity. There's no way I'm going there. And he goes, and I said, no, I don't think I want to go to Shasta, because he has a reunion every year in Shasta, but it's all Spanish speaking people. There are about 200 people. He does meditation.
I didn't know this. I live 90 minutes away from Shasta.
Well, he's going to do it again next year.
I didn't know.
So, he told me, and I said no, and then he texted me from Malaga in Spain, and he said, Paula, he said, you must be there. You were invited. We will get you the tent. We will make sure that somebody picks you up, and you should come to Shasta. So I hate camping, Jeff. I hate it. What I didn't know is that they were also fasting. So I brought an apple, and I had to cut it into 16 pieces in 3 days. That's how I was eating. Because that's what they do. They recite Om and these mantras so that they set a vibrational tone so that the beings.
Well, 57 different species of them, no telling which ones will show up. That's very interesting. Not all of this dimension either, I would imagine. They're multi.
No, this was a physical encounter, though. I didn't expect it because he had said with Ricardo, he has program settings, so he'll say the craft will come over at 9:33.
Mm-hmm.
And 9:33, it's there. He did it for Grant Cameron last year.
Mm-hmm.
Grant Cameron came to Shasta.
Mm-hmm.
He said the craft will come over your head at 9:33. Sure enough, there were 100 people. The craft was over Grant Cameron's head at 9:33.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And they do it through automatic riding. Well, when I showed up at Shasta, all I could think about, I froze to death, was going home. I just couldn't wait till it was over. But the last day, he came over to me at 11 o'clock. I mean, I was starving. I wanted to go home. I thought, this is beautiful. Great time.
3 days without food.
Yeah, well,
You snuck a little. I get it.
Snuck my apple. So he said, Paula, Antarel is in the forest. Can you handle it? What would you have said? I said, okay. And he said, you're going to go with three other, he said, there's two people down there. You're going to hold the hands of these two women. Of course, nobody speaks English.
Paula, let's stop right there before we go into the forest. I want to come back. We've got to take a break. We'll come back and tell us that story. Then I want to get into your photos. We'll do kind of a survey of Paula Harris in this program tonight. Let me remind everyone about your books, too. Go to paulaharris.com. You can click on her name. Conversations with Colonel Corso, a personal memoir and photo album. This is a 2017 book. I just wish I had the time to sit down and read these things. UFOs, All the Above and Beyond, 2017. UFOs, How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light, revised 2012. Exopolitics, A Stargate to a New Reality, Exopolitics, all of the above, connecting the dots, making sense of the UFO phenomenon, and more to come. We'll be right back with Paula Harris. Hang on.